You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Alex. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Alex Komorowski, co-founder of a very interesting company called Common Tools, which we'll get around to talking about. Before that, you were head of corporate strategy at Stripe, I think. Mm-hmm. And before that, you were at Google. What was your title at Google?
I finished up as a director of product management. And I was actually, that was my first job I ever had. So I started from as an associate product manager and kind of rose through the ranks and ended up after 13 years at sometime before that as a director of product management.
Okay. Well, that sounds important. Were you important?
No,
it's the correct answer. You're supposed to act humble.
Yeah,
was the right answer.
So I think I had lasting impact in very atypical ways. So I mentored lots of product managers over the years, and I accidentally wrote down a lot of guidance that other people have called the Bible of PMing at Google. And I still, once a month,
PM being product management.
I'm sorry.
PM being product management.
Yeah, product management. That's right.
Right.
And who's like kind of like the CEO of a feature or product, maybe. And I still about once a month get an email from some random person I never met from Google who says, "Thank you so much for writing such great guidance." So either, mm-hmm, I guess they're still using it, 5 years later.
So all the good products that come out of Google are from people who read your manifesto or whatever, and all the bad products are from people who failed to.
That's correct.
Okay, good. Congratulations. I'm really fascinated by this company you've co-founded, Common Tools, because whenever you ask anybody in Silicon Valley like what the mission of the company is, they say it's to make the world a better place. Sometimes I think that's really what they believe. Sometimes I think it isn't, and sometimes I think they believe it. But if you could delve into their unconscious mind, you might find evidence that it's not the true deep motivation. In your case, I got to say, I've talked to you a few times, just conversationally about AI. And I get the sense that your motives are actually pretty pure. You don't have to be so humble.
I agree. And for me, this is like the real, I do this because I think it is, for me, my priority stack is this the right thing for society? And then is the right thing for the country I live in, down for the company I work for, the team I'm on, what's good for me individually? Like, that's the priority stack. But if I don't, mm-hmm, believe the thing I'm working on is my highest and best use for society in a way that I'll be proud of, not just having an impact, because in tech, we often talk about, I had an impact. It's like, yeah, but like a good one, And so it's got to be something. For me, the mental test is every decision I make, I try to imagine, even micro decisions, some part of this, if I were to show a video of this decision 10 mm-hmm. years from now in front of a lot of people whose opinions I cared about, so my parents, my husband, my role models, my ancestors, would I be ideally proud of this decision and at the mm-hmm. very least not embarrassed? And if I would be embarrassed of that decision, then don't do it. Mm-hmm. That's a bad sign, right?
So let me say... the way you approach this just now is actually very characteristic of you. That's why you're the kind of guy who would write up this thing that you would leave behind at Google. You just are very habitually analytical about life and the tech landscape and everything. And that's one reason I enjoy talking to you. I mean, sometimes you go so fast that I can't entirely follow you, but I trust that you're saying something important even when I don't understand it. So the way I want to get back to this company you've co-founded is by meandering through the contemporary artificial intelligence landscape. In particular, I want to look at, the big frontier model makers. And I think we'll take OpenAI as kind of iconic and somewhat typical, in some ways distinctive. But in any event, I want to talk through kind of where you think they are, what their business model is, what their ambitions are, how you think that will work out. And I think this will lead kind of organically to discussion of your company, because I know your mission is partly about avoiding some of the future paths that we could take that the current trajectory could lead to. And you'd rather that we not wind up there. I'll say that much now. And but why don't we start now about with OpenAI? And I think, well, why don't you tell us? I think an important one thing that worries you is the idea like of one large language model ruling us all in some sense, or ruling them all. And it's not I think that's not the only sense in which you worry about centralization, but it's one of them. So why don't you talk about what you think Sam Altman's model, business model is, where he hopes this is going to go, and how he hopes to get there, so far as you can tell.
So I don't know what Sam Altman's thinking, as I can't get inside his brain, but I can see what someone in his position, what the market forces would lead that person to sort of try to execute. Mm-hmm. And let me just say it off the bat. I believe that large language models, LLMs, which I'll use that acronym a lot today, I'm sure, is, I think they're as important and will be as impactful as the printing press, electricity, and the internet. I think they are truly a transformative technology. I think by default, what everyone talks about, you have people who think that AI isn't very interesting, which I think are wrong. But the applications that we've used them for so far is, like, to me, some of the lamest, worst, just sort of unimaginative approaches to it. Or the people who are like, AGI is imminent, ASI is going to happen, it's going to destroy humanity. I'm not in that camp. I think we're seeing clear evidence of the models, this approach kind of hitting a ceiling, which is good, I think. So I personally am not that worried about like runaway ASI. Maybe I should be more worried, but that's not a thing that I constantly think about. What I am worried about is one that people don't really talk about that much, which is the tech industry, especially in the last 10 years, has led to enormous centralization. Very small number of extremely powerful companies. In the tech industry, they're called aggregators. These are companies like Google, Facebook, OpenAI is definitely trying to become one. And they're ones that all of the users use to access a given kind of service. And that means they have very strong control over the ecosystem of suppliers and the whole ecosystem.
Can we stop there and just flesh out the term aggregators a little? I mean, one early use of that was just like in a kind of media sense, like if you start a site that links to a bunch of different media sites, you're aggregating those. But the kinds of aggregators you're talking about are on a larger, so social media is an aggregator, right? In the sense that, I mean, what they have in common with what I just said is the content comes from a lot of places, but in this case, millions of users. And because you can get the content there, the demand wants to go there, right?
Yeah. So the term aggregator in this context comes from Ben Thompson, who is one of the best analysts of the tech industry. Like, he really gets
the Stratechery newsletter. Mm-hmm. And so
this is his frame, but it's a phenomenon that shows up everywhere, which is network effects lead to winners that get an early lead, getting a larger and larger and larger lead. Mm-hmm. And technology in the tech industry is just dominated by network effects. One way to think about this is a business that is based on atoms and moving atoms physically around the world. Like, I sell bananas, I got to get the banana to the customer. And I got to get it to them fast enough that it doesn't go bad. That's a hard business. It's really hard to move atoms through the world, especially when they've got to move a really far distance. In tech, we work, especially in software, we work almost entirely in bits. Bits can be transmitted anywhere on Earth, basically instantly for basically free. And that is radically different. And it allows the centralization effects of these network effects to run way hotter than they do in basically any other industry. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to these things where what happens with an aggregator is there's a superior consumer experience. Consumers all go there as the front door. That's the service they use. And now as more and more of them go and it becomes more and more useful, as there's more and more people there, more and more features, the providers of content or experiences have no choice but to make their content available inside that aggregator. Which means they're totally beholden to the rules of that aggregator. The aggregator can, like, go, you know, for example, Apple's an aggregator. Mm-hmm. And if you say, oh, I want to have my my iPhone app approved, and it does this thing that is kind of competitive with your business model, they'll go, yeah, no. Mm-hmm. Like, well, wait a second. What? This is like the most important computing device on Earth. And they gate all things that can happen on it for their users. That's insane. But like, that's the way that aggregators work, is they gate because they control all of the user attention. They gate all of the sort of supply has to work on their terms.
And so the network effects you referred to kind of naturally tend toward a winner-take-all situation. Now, as it happens, there's usually a couple of related kind of, there's like Twitter, there's Facebook, there's this, but there's usually not many. And in the case of social media, they all have such distinctive properties that often there's only one that's exactly Twitter has things, like if you're a journalist, for example, Twitter has things you won't really find anywhere else. So anyway, so you naturally move toward a winner-take-all market. Now, we'll flesh out the aggregator thing in the context of large language models a little bit. So what kind of dynamic is OpenAI hoping to harness that will lead it to world dominance?
So this is in, there's one world of this, which is the stated beliefs around ASI and the company that creates ASI will be so powerful beyond other ones.
Artificial superintelligence.
Yeah. And so that's the one move. And there are a lot of true believers in a lot of the major labs that they're imminence and it's going to work. It's gonna, really important. It's important. The good guys win. And so they really got to do this. But there's also a way more prosaic view on companies like OpenAI, which is just kind of like the same dynamics of other tech companies around social media and others. And this is all about aggregation and sort of distribution advantages. And OpenAI also has a memo that was leaked a year ago or so that talks about, our goal is to make the one super assistant everyone uses. Makes sense. I get why they'd want to make that feature. And if you have all users use that super assistant, it's very hard for them to leave. It's very sticky, as they say in the business. That's the polite term for it. And it means that they have tons of leverage and control. And if anyone wants to advertise to or show experiences or distribute things there, cool. You got to go by what the aggregator says.
Right.
And they can say,
Can I say one? So right now, there are these companies and entrepreneurs who are trying to harness an alternative model by, filling these niches like, we have therapy bot. We have MD bot. We have career counseling bot. You're saying OpenAI wants to be all of those things. It wants to be the one AI you go to.
It wants to be the one AI you go to. The one experience that you go to has all the memories on you. It's your, it's your coworker. It's your therapist, which by the way, those can't be the same person. That doesn't make any sense. But like, that's the product vision implied by the one chatbot tool of them all.
Well, it could have a split personality though, right?
I mean, it could, but like that already is like a weird.
But it feels weird if your coworker knows like your private business.
Yeah, and like they'll be like, "Don't worry, I didn't tell them about the hemorrhoids thing." It's like, I don't want you to even know I have hemorrhoids, And so like that doesn't really track as a. One of the things I believe the chatbot form factor, everyone thinks that is what AI is. That is incorrect. AI chatbot is the most obvious manifestation of large language models. If you gave a product manager, you said, I have large language models, and you said, you have 5 minutes to come up with a product, they'd say chatbot. Duh. Mm-hmm. What else are they going to say? And then that's what we've been doing for the past few years. That's what everyone's been sort of executing on. Chatbots as a form function, though, I think is like kind of a weird interaction. Chat is great for certain kinds of use cases where you have an open-ended question or it's a one-off. They're terrible for ongoing or structured interactions, working with other people. Like an weird example.
What's an example of something where the chatbot manifestation of the LLM wouldn't really work for you or wouldn't work completely and you'd be using some other aspect of an LLM?
So here's an example that like if you were trying to search and find something that requires you to figure out how to walk from one place to the other and via a chatbot and you can't, you aren't actually having it walking, talking with you where to turn or whatever. Like there's lots of features that need spatial, to see a map or to see buttons. In the tech industry, we call buttons affordances, as in they show you there's a thing you could do. Here's the actions you could take. There's a button right here. There's a thing right here. And 70% of our brains or something like that are devoted to spatial awareness. And so that's one of the reasons UI is they put data and you know that you can glance back up at it. It's always going to be there. And having a chatbot, which is one just kind of like stream of text constantly going past you, is, again, great for certain use cases. But the idea that like that will be the only way you interact with computers ever for everything, like, that doesn't sound right.
Now, but this idea hasn't escaped the attention of the big companies, right? Like AI glasses, which Meta's really big into, are an example of presenting people with ultimately a visual interface as well as others, right? I mean,
yeah, it's people have like, although I would point out that most of those kinds of things that people have shown off are often chatbots with a small bit of visual kind of like specialized UI it shows you in a moment. I think this is not, what I'm saying is not that like no one has any imagination. It's just that like for some reason, chatbot has captured the entire imagination of everyone. And like people were making a chatbot for this feature or this feature. It's like, guys, the centralized one, is this going to be the best one? And the that's going to like steamroll your...
What do you mean by that? You mean the company that really does it all, not just chatbots,
yeah,
is going to be dominant.
One way of putting this is if chatbot is the primary UX for AI for the foreseeable future for the next 10 years, mm-hmm. OpenAI is one. It's like not going to change. Like they're already well on their way to becoming the aggregator. I believe that chatbot is not going to, it's going to, you know, have a low ceiling. There's going to be a ton of other stuff that you want to do with LLMs and can do. And that's like, for example, one of the things that LLMs can do really well, the way I put this is qualitative nuance at quantitative scale. We've never had this before. Before, if you wanted to scale calculations or statistics, it had to be reduced to numbers. And now LLMs have infinite patience. So you can give them the raw data, you know, in sort of unstructured form. And if you have enough compute credits and you have enough time, they will do the analysis. And that's crazy. That's so powerful. One of the outcomes, one of the things that's downstream of this is LLMs can write shitty software in the small for basically free. The tech industry, as it exists today, is predicated on the idea that software is expensive to write and cheap to execute. And LLMs mess with both of those because software that uses LLMs to execute is too expensive to be supported by ads. And now it's like trivial to write little bits of software on demand for, you know, people who are somewhat savvy. And that's wild. That is very unlike what's been true for all of tech.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, OpenAI, they're thinking about most of this stuff. I mean, they're certainly into software and they're aware of the economics. I mean, in other words, it's not like you think OpenAI, if their goal is to dominate the world, which it seems to be, and what corporation doesn't want to dominate as completely as they can, if their goal is that, you don't think they're going about it in fundamentally the wrong way.
Oh,
right?
No,
you
no,
think
no.
Sam Altman gets the picture.
Oh, yeah, they get the picture for sure. And mm-hmm. I think, like, I find that aggregators lead to outcomes in society that are less than ideal for society. They lead to a lack of competition. You don't really get choice between different services, which means that they don't really have to compete to be very good. So I think aggregation is bad for society. It's like over-optimization, kind of. And also, if you are an executive in a company and you have a opportunity to be an aggregator fall in your lap, you have to do it. It's like your fiduciary duty to attempt to. Mm-hmm. Aggregators are like becoming a successful aggregator is like winning the lottery. It's like if you had a winning lottery ticket, of course you're gonna, right? You're gonna like scratch. You're gonna turn it in. So like, I like the fact that they now are in a position where it plausibly could be a new aggregator. Like I understand why they're taking it. I understand why the actions they're doing. And I don't begrudge them. Like that's exactly what they should do in some sense, because they have an opportunity in front of them. I happen to think it's not great for society. But like for them as a company, it would be literally, you know, unthinkable to do this.
What are the bad things for society about, I don't know if it's the aggregator model per se or the kind of monopolistic stature of an eventual winning aggregator or something else. But what are your biggest concerns about where we may be heading?
So there's a number of them. One is something simple. If everyone's using the same LLM, and if you're using a chatbot that's baked in with one large language model, then every single little bias it has is multiplied to society scale. Mm-hmm. So for whatever reason, it really likes the word delve, for example. Great. You're going to see delve all over the place in communication. And that's a kind of funny example, but you have all kinds of these little blind spots and whatever. And someone in a position of that power could say, yeah, you know what? Don't talk about this political party or whatever. Sure. It's totally plausible for someone to do. I'm not saying they have. I'm just saying it's plausible when you have that kind of centralized control. That's one of the smallest versions of this. Another version is this qualitative nuance at quantitative scale. It can be used for you or it can be used against you. So imagine your therapist being owned by a corporation. So I know someone, I don't know them personally. My lead investor knows them. She uses ChatGPT a lot. And she asked it, hey, how would you manipulate me if you had to? And it says, oh, I would never manipulate you. And then she goes, okay, but like, what if you had to? And it goes, well, you appear to travel a lot for work. Because when you do, you ask questions and use ChatGPT at a different time than normal. And when you do, you appear to be much more emotionally vulnerable. You appear to be lonely and more insecure. And so what I would do is wait until you were asking me questions outside of your normal time zone. And then I would subtly start leaning into your insecurity around your weight. And then it has this whole plan It goes on. It's a good plan.
She must have known how to prompt it to get that kind of.
Right. So I'm not saying that it would do that intentionally. I'm just observing that if somebody sitting in a position of power goes, you know what, let's blackmail all these five people or whatever, it could do it. And yeah. I'm not saying anyone would do that. I'm not saying that someone at OpenAI would do that. I'm just saying, on behalf of society, I would rather nobody to be in a position. I don't want won't be evil. Mm-hmm. I want can't be evil. I don't want anyone mm-hmm. to be in that position. I have to say no to that behavior.
Just as a kind of a footnote here, a brief tangent. What kind of blows my mind about that is partly the almost self-awareness, like the meta-awareness of the strategy it would deploy. I mean, it's one thing if you keep reinforcing these machines for keeping people engaged, or if you reinforce them for selling products to people, it's one thing for them to do that. But the fact that then you ask them about it hypothetically and they say, this is what I do, we don't know for sure that it is exactly what it would do, but it's still, you know what I mean? I mean, this is
the point of any hyperscale consumer product in tech falls into like a gravity well where it must optimize for engagement.
Sure.
And the reason is because if it doesn't, like the only thing that's scarce is attention. And, you know, at one point, sometime many years ago, the Netflix CEO said, you know, our main competitor is sleep. And like he kind of said as a joke, but like, and they, by the way, have actually changed the way they optimize their metrics to be something that I think is actually a good example to emulate since then. But like, that's the natural thing you fall into of like, if I don't optimize, like, let me tell you a story. This is slightly stylized of assembling a few real examples. I was talking to someone back at one of my former employers many years ago. I was mentoring somebody and they were working on a ranking problem that was about ranking videos. Yeah. And this person goes, some junior product manager comes to me. I'd never met her before. And she says, Alex, I have an idea for a ranking change. I don't want you to give me thoughts on the proposal. I just want you to tell me how to ship it. And I said, okay. So I skimmed the proposal. I said, what's your engineering manager think? What's your VP think? And they go, wait a second. Isn't the second order implication of this ranking change bad for this set of creators, video creators we care about? Not terrible, but that's definitely worse than today. It isn't that bad for our users. It isn't that bad for the company. It isn't that bad for society. And the PM goes, Alex, who's to say? I said, well, you're the one who says that we should change the thing. Shouldn't you have an opinion that this is good? And she said, Alex, everybody here knows that our goal is to increase watch time. Because if we don't, the bad guys, TikTok, will win. And so now that's what we're supposed to optimize for. My manager told me that I'm in danger of missing expectations in my next performance review because I'm not moving metrics that matter. Mm-hmm. This will increase watch time. Uh-huh. What do you want me to do? And I think that little story kind of encapsulates the like dynamics, the emergent dynamics uh-huh. inside of some of these organizations. That even if nobody intentionally is doing a thing that it takes these shortcuts or whatever, you still fall into this thing. Of course you are, because otherwise those baddies right there will just do the same damn thing. And at least, you know, it'd be better for society if my one does it.
Did you say that person is at Meta or did you not say?
I did not say that. I did not say where they are.
Although if the enemy is TikTok, one can imagine a Meta product that.
And you can. I never worked at Meta, so that was not at Meta. I did talk to somebody. Okay. It's one of these big companies at one point, and someone goes, you know, Alex, despite what users say, the metrics are very clear. People love doom scrolling. And it's like, wow. That's not love. That's addiction. Like that's just because they do it doesn't mean they like it.
Alex, what's wrong with you? Yeah. Get with the program. Okay. So yeah. So engagement. They optimize for engagement, and this has already led to well-known issues like sycophancy. I did notice, by the way, that OpenAI just today, I think Sam Altman or yesterday, someone was tweeting about version 5.1. of ChatGPT, and it has, and one of the modes you can select is apparently candor, which I guess is supposed to be the alternative to sycophancy. I don't know if it'll be true.
But here's the thing: no one's going to pick it. Like everybody says, because everybody says, then you know what? They'll feel better knowing that there is an option. And OpenAI will say, "Oh, look, there's an option. People don't pick it. Of course, they'll pick it. Nobody wants to hear. If you had to choose between somebody." Who laughs at all your jokes and says, what an astute observation to every stupid thing you said. Like everyone says, no, I want the one that's candid. No, you don't. Because then it's going to tell you your idea is dumb. And you're going to go, okay, but like it's wrong about this one. So like, people will just have a natural tendency towards the one that makes them feel smart and funny.
But that's a generic problem that we really should ponder. And I've heard you say that, and I've thought about this and talked about it with people, but I've heard you use the phrase you've used is, you know, the difference between what you want, like the junk food, and what you want to want, you know, what the better angels in you wants to want. We want, in some sense, it's good for society and for people to have large language models that give them what they want to want, not necessarily what they want in the moment. But what alternative is there to people, in effect, choosing candor, right? In other words, the market left to its own devices. I mean, first of all, you probably wouldn't want a system where we impose these kind of stentorian Sunday school teacher models on people.
Absolutely.
And so you're going to leave it to consumer choice. And isn't the challenge to convince people that they want a model that doesn't unduly suck up to them and does, you know, tend to give them the honest truth, even when it's unpleasant, and doesn't suck them into the AI equivalent of doom scrolling and all that? I mean, it seems like almost an educational challenge for the society.
Yeah. The fact is, people like these products better in the short term. People like fast food. Like that is like, it's fundamentally, right. It tastes great in the moment. You know, you've always been to do it, but like, oh, it's been a really stressful day today. I don't want to treat myself, you know? So like, this is fundamentally true. And you shouldn't say, well, therefore you can't have fast food. No, of course not. Like you're a human. Like you should be able to make decisions about what you do to your own body. If it doesn't hurt somebody else, like go for it. But like, structurally, you can get stuck in these positions where this is the only thing that you're like, we're basically in a intellectual food desert, effectively, right? Mm-hmm. Around like, there isn't something that allows you to go into these deeper things. And if you can, like, it's very hard to turn on and what have you. But somewhat surprisingly, I think the answer is the security model of software distribution. And I know that sounds insane, but the security model of software distribution sets the laws of physics, effectively, uh-huh. for how software is distributed. And it's the thing that 30 years ago, in 1994, 31 years ago, I guess, there was a fateful decision called the same origin paradigm. And some folks at Netscape, when they created JavaScript.
Okay, I'm gonna let you continue, but are we starting to head toward like what your company does?
We are, but the reason, I guess, is because, let me take one step back and let me say a slightly different, broader frame. There's I think there's two kinds of things that look very superficially similar, but are very fundamentally different. Mm-hmm. And the first is hollow, and the second is resonant. And hollow things are things that afterwards leave you feeling regret. And resonant things afterwards leave you feeling nourished. And they superficially look very similar. In the moment, you like both of them. But afterwards, you know, would you recommend it proudly to a friend? Or you're like, I shouldn't have done that. And I think that modern society, technology, business, politics, all select for hollow things, not resonant things. Because what we can optimize for is the thing that like gives you that hit of like, yeah, I like that thing. I'll choose to use it again. Okay, but like, are you proud of it? Like, do you feel that nourished you, or do you feel like it was just a thing that tasted good in the moment? And so I think all of society, the modern society, the problem is that we have over-optimized into exclusively hollow experiences basically everywhere. I think tech is very guilty of this, but I also think politics and business in general is very guilty of this. And this has led to a crisis of meaning, frankly, for society, where we feel full and yet totally empty. And like, I feel like that is a, like the characteristic of modern society. And one of the reasons that we're all feeling so skittish. And part of the reason that happened is because we just optimized the crap out of everything. We just look, I don't know, the numbers told us to like drive the society off a cliff. So we did it. Like, why? Like, that's bad, right? Like, you know, like nobody wants to want that kind of thing. And yet we just followed along the gradients of optimization.
So, okay. So I want to mention, before we get back to the security model of software distribution and start moving toward what your company Common Tools is trying to build, I want to mention one more issue I've heard you talk about that's also about centralization in the world of large language models, but it's not necessarily monopoly central in the monopoly sense. It's not that there would necessarily only be one company. It's that all your data, everything about you, the knowledge about you would be extensive and would all be at one company. So if Sam Altman's dream is realized and I decide, you know, it really is easiest if it's just one model that does it all for me. And conceivably, maybe I'll click a button and say, now I'm talking to my therapist. Who knows?
But they can make it fully within their thing.
It's always ChatGPT, and OpenAI has access to all the data. And they say they have to serve me well, so that it can act like a friend who knows me, it can act like a therapist who knows me, and so on.
And to be clear, by the way, everyone at OpenAI, you could imagine, even in a world where every single person at OpenAI earnestly believed that they were doing the right thing for society, you would still follow it. So I'm not saying imputing anyone's motives. I'm just saying the fundamental, inescapable thing to make the product better.
Yeah, no, the business logic leads us there in the current world is what you're... Okay, so that's another concern. You're worried about, you know, giving people what they want, not what they want to want. You're worried about the centralization of data, which is an even bigger problem if there is monopolistic centralization. So there's just no conceivable alternative. Okay. Are those the main concerns we need to get back to where...
Those are the main concerns. Okay. Let me unpack. There's a difference between chatbots and large language models. Mm-hmm. And the difference is the chatbot is a vertically integrated consumer experience that stores memories, and the large language model does not.
Right.
And there's one of the like laws of, you know, fundamental laws of business, and especially in the tech industry, is the entity that stores the useful state has the leverage. And so the chatbot that you use that has memories that are useful to you has a ton of leverage because now you can't go elsewhere. If you have a thing that you own on top that with stores your memories, and you can swap between different models from different providers whenever you want, that's great. That allows you to swap and see how they behave. It doesn't give any one of them too much power. And that's exactly the reason that someone like... What's funny about these models, by the way, they're extremely capital intensive to produce, and also they're commodity. Because there's a handful of labs that all have basically the frontier labs that have similar quality for similar costs, and they're fighting to bring quality up and cost down. That is great for society. The terrible business. You put tons of money in, and you can't charge for it very much. Mm-hmm. And so that's why all of the providers want desperately to move up the stack into something where they can add differentiation and lock in. Like sticky is what's called historically.
So,
you know,
so by up the stack, you mean what?
An application that stores data and your memories in it that you come to proactively.
Right.
I would argue if ChatGPT, if OpenAI had to split, and they had to split the ChatGPT product and have it use any model or their model, which one would they pick? They choose this one. Mm-hmm. And the reason they choose the top one is because that's the one that has compounding advantage and is really sticky and is the actual advantage that they have. Now they could swap out to someone else's model. It would just be fine. You know,
like a good open source model.
The open source models are not quite good enough. At some point, they will be good enough, but they're not quite good enough yet. But like, I don't know, there's like multiple options they could swap out to. And so like, this would never happen.
I think it's important to dwell on this for a second. You're saying that at one level, the business model is inherently fragile in the sense that, you know, I can be using ChatGPT today, and if they raise their price by 1 cent per token or whatever, they just do anything I don't like, I can move to Claude.
If you're using the chatbot as a user, you cannot move. But if you're using the
API, that's what I was going to say. Is that the only reason you can't move is because is to the extent that that the quality of its service to you draws on its pre-existing knowledge about you. That's what locks me in, right? As just a chatbot consumer, that's their ace in the hole. Is the more they know about me and draw on that, the harder it is for me to move to a rival.
That's correct. And so it requires storing state memories and for them to be useful. So you as a user want to use the service that knows the most about you. And again, they do that by providing a service that people like. And that makes total sense. They should do that. But it just leads to this dynamic. And this is not an accidental dynamic. Anyone who's ever thought about strategy for a second in tech will be like, duh, guys, we have this thing. It's like the business model of the model providers looks like is most equivalent to me of like cell phone networks, of like extremely capital intensive and also very little pricing power, really, because they are, there's a number of them and they're competitive and they're relatively easy to swap between. And that's the worst nightmare of the model providers, because there's no reason that you don't get any kind of competitive edge for this massive expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
So like the business models of them are downstream of today. Why are they doing this? They're doing this because there is some hedge that ASI really will be achieved, and the company that achieves it first will be the god, king, emperor of society forever, and then everyone who invested in them will be...
Even if it's not ASI, the logic still makes sense. I mean, the ASI thing is one reason they seem to, Dario seems to think that only, that he has to win the race because he's a good guy and Sam's not and whatever. But I mean, even if you don't get to ASI, a lot of this logic still holds because, and I think this only holds
if it is a compounding, like effectively infinite value capture. And
what do you mean by that? I think it can be if you mean they can hang on to me forever, even if they don't get to ASI,
I guess what I'd say is ASI is say 1,000x prize, and getting an aggregator that people never stop using for the rest of their life is like a 1x prize. It's like a normal prize. It's a good prize. And everything else is 0.0001x kind of. But like ASI is orders of magnitude beyond the prize of
why? How does that lead them to get more money out of me than just say what I imagine, LLMs being in about a year and a half, which is that they'll just do a ton of shit for me. And like, what does ASI bring that doesn't?
ASI. So like, I actually don't like thinking about ASI because I find it very hard to reason about. And I think it's very hard to have a principled take on it because it basically says, a friend of mine, Ben Mathis, has this frame I love. He calls it the smuggled infinity. And basically, once you smuggle an infinity into an argument, everything else in the argument downstream of that is now absurd. Because the only thing, like infinity times anything other than zero is infinity. And so the word perfect or ASI are implicitly infinite. And so people say, well, if this is the case, and it's infinite and it never, it might supersede humans and kill all the humans. And like, it's just impossible to reason about because it's this infinity. So like, but that is the logic of like, if there is an ASI thing, all kinds of assumptions, like do humans need to exist anymore? Like there's all kinds of crazy
I get
things.
It's
not like you as a user, which product do you like? It's like, do you as a person even exist anymore is kind of the question. And the what kinds of emergent social structures show
and
up?
By the way,
it just changes everything.
You're not much of a doomer, but do you have some concern for the extreme doom scenarios? I mean, your P doom would be low, I think, but it's not zero
it's not zero. And, and to me, I worry more. Stuart Russell, who's a distinguished professor at Berkeley, I was just getting coffee with him a week or so ago. He has this frame of like, he is more of a nervous about the ASI, kind of runaway ASI, I think, not to mischaracterize his position potentially, but he said like, this is like the ASI race is like a race to the edge of a cliff. All it takes is one person to go over the edge and it ruins it for society. And like, no one's going to stop right at the level, right? They're going to go over accidentally.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a coherent and well-formed fear. I just think that realistically, everyone's doing this. Oh, it's compounding to infinity. No, nothing compounds to infinity. Everything is an S-curve. And you can see this very clearly.
Let me stop and try to consolidate where I think maybe we are. And an issue I still kind of have, which is, I mean, first, let's just say, okay, so artificial general intelligence, people may wonder, why is it that they were saying AGI 6 months ago, and now everybody's saying ASI? As I understand the difference, it's like, okay, so AGI, people have different definitions, but it kind of means you can do anything a person can do, roughly speaking. And then ASI is kind of beyond that. And I think one key element of this whole conceptualization is the idea, which makes sense to me, that as you get to AGI, the cycle of innovation is accelerating because the AI, I mean, it's happening even now in a way because AI is helping people code. So it's accelerating progress at these labs. And the idea, the standard, I think, scenario is you get to AGI, things are moving faster and faster, and then whoosh, super fast, you're in this realm called ASI. Which is super amazing. Is that the basic idea, first of all?
But I spend very little of my time thinking about ASI because I find it hard to reason about and like kind of fanciful.
Right.
So like I should say that this is my interpretation of it, not thinking about it too much. It's, people call it the singularity. It's this moment where everything kind of crosses a chasm it can't even reason about because it was moved so fast. And there's an argument that using AI to write AI faster than humans could and swarm on it faster than humans could lead to a model performance that, it just starts compounding infinitely into a thing that quickly eclipses what we can even reason about. Mm-hmm. That's a coherent idea. Like it is totally possible that is the case. I think realistically it's unlikely. Mm-hmm. And because this compounding things don't compound for nothing. Mm-hmm. The compounding infinitely is basically impossible, physically impossible. And also you see these clear evidence of S curves, like the ChatGPT 5.1 came out a couple of days ago. I run this little think tank that's got a bunch of people who are like pretty preeminent in the field of applying AI and at some of these labs. And none of us talked about it. We were just talking yesterday. We didn't talk about it at all. And someone goes, hey, didn't ChatGPT 5.1 come out today? We're like, yeah. Like, they're like, does anyone have any thoughts about it? I think it's interesting. And I was like, no. And one of the reasons for this is, I think a good way of understanding this mental model is if you have a video game, at the very beginning, if you have like 40 triangles to make up someone's face, it looks like shit. And you add 400 triangles, it looks a lot better. And then you add 4,000, it looks even better. And then it gets this clear, like you add, you know, 400,000, like,
yeah, you get 4 million. Beyond the resolution.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. This is extra. Who cares? And I think we're clearly in that, like, these models are so powerful for individual tasks. They're well-formed for them.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. When I sound skeptical that superintelligence adds 1,000 time, you know, multiplies the value of monopolistic dominance or whatever by a factor of 1,000, that's why I'm skeptical. It's like we're not far from everything I think I'll need. Now it needs to be more and more richly multimodal and have all of these senses and so on. But you don't. Anyway, I don't want to have that discussion so much. But I just wanted to say that I think I agree with you. Not that superintelligence won't be the super important thing, but that it seems to me monopolistic dominance. I mean, one way to ask the question is, are these companies going to get their money back? Or some of them? I mean, they're operating at a loss and they're incurring these huge financial obligations. OpenAI has promised over $1 trillion.
That's insane. It's an insane statement. Like, right. Like, and the, I'm not saying what their strategy is and what it isn't. I'm just saying that like the idea of trying to make a case of $1 trillion payback is insane. And the, I think LLMs, again, are as important as the printing press, electricity, and the internet. I think it's real. And also, this idea that like chatbots are going to lead to a tweet. What? Is everyone high? Like, what is happening? That's definitely not going to be the case. And so that's the part that makes me nervous of like, it's one of the things that makes me nervous in this world is like a, you know, like I'm not saying anyone's doing this. I'm just saying if you were trying to raise as much capital as possible to win the race, it'd be in your interest to have to talk about ASI, 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 ASI. So all the people who are funding you go, if it's true, it's like an infinite return. And so like, if it's, you know, 0.1% chance of infinity is still infinity, so we should do it. It would be in your interest to talk about this. Meanwhile, you're just doing a very basic monopolistic play of like, we're just gonna make an aggregator that no one can leave in the normal way. And like, no one's gonna be talking about it because they're all like, ooh, ASI is gonna steal a job. It's gonna ruin society. And like, meanwhile, we just have a just very generic monopoly growing in front of everybody. Like that, I'm not saying that's what anyone's doing. I'm just saying, you know, I can see how that would happen.
I can personally see that becoming pretty valuable. But in any way, to get back to your mission, the part of their plan, given the extent to which LLMs are kind of like commodities or the ease and principle of switching from one LLM to another, an important part of their model has to be some form of lock-in, some form of stickiness. And you're saying a big one is that they are going to have all of your information in their silo. And the longer you stay with them, the more they use that to keep you there. And by the way, I would say, I mean, you think back on that anecdote you shared with that woman who said to the LLM, you know, how would you use this information about me? That is the way you expect something. If something wants to maximize engagement, keep you with it and knows everything about it, it will just automatically, without anybody malicious being the CEO, it will just automatically seek out your vulnerabilities in some sense. And that's one thing you're concerned about.
Yeah, I'm saying that no one even has to do it intentionally. It just happens. You know, like that's the part that's like
the
an
only
automatic
business
thing.
Model in town. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So now is of the two things we've mentioned, want versus want-to-want, and then this you know, collection of all your information in a single company, is that latter, the second of those, more directly related to what your company Common Tools is about?
So what we do is we're trying to make an open decentralized software distribution ecosystem. And one way of thinking about it is like, imagine TikTok for software, if it were open and also nourishing and good for society, which is, you know, not the case for TikTok. But something where you have software that can distribute itself instead of feeling like you're going to a big box store to buy software that someone made that like it's kind of one size fits none. What if software felt like something that was growing in your personal garden? that was just aligning with your aspirations naturally, didn't think about it too much. It helped you become the kind of person you wanted to be and engage in the world in the way that you wanted to be and help you lean into the stuff, your aspirations and the things that were important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat surprisingly, I think the thing necessary to make that true is a radically different security model. So the security model we've used for software for the past 30 years is called the same origin paradigm. It's actually a hotfix. It was introduced in 1994 by the Netscape team after they shipped JavaScript. And someone goes, oh, crap. Someone could steal someone's cookies from another site. We need a way to partition those. And someone goes, oh, well, let's have this notion of an origin. That's kind of like the domain, the web, you know, the website that you're at. And then over time, that became a larger and larger and larger boundary. And then apps came along and said, we'll use that model too. And now we're in a world where all basically all software we use every day outside of the B2B context works this way.
Okay, and, so but can we drill down on that? So you said same origin. So
yeah, same origin paradigm, yep.
So in other words, and the origin is what? Whatever website you're at, or it's the browser?
So the origin would be whichever domain you're at, like, you know, google.com or what app you're using. So
okay,
in the same origin model, each of these things is a totally partitioned universe, mm-hmm. totally separated from the other one.
So the way we ensure security, to the extent that we do, is to kind of build strong walls around each of these domains, right? Like,
that's correct.
You can't come in and get my cookies that are at Google. So
only Google can get the cookies that's Google stored is the kind of core of the model.
Now that sounds innocuous to me.
It's great. No, it's a very reasonable model.
Mm-hmm,
The downside of it actually is the second order implications. And the second order implications of the same origin model, one of the things it does is it says you as a user must trust the creator of that code, the owner of that origin of that site, in an open-ended way to be responsible with your data. Which is kind of a crazy statement because, you know, you're saying basically, I trust them to not accidentally get hacked or not to intentionally use my data in a way I wouldn't like. And that's a very hard blanket statement to make for a domain, for an origin, because maybe I trust them for this use, but not that use, or I trust them now, but not if they get bought by private equity in 5 years.
Yeah.
And it's not possible to express those kinds of things.
Right.
So the sin of the same origin paradigm was fusing apps and data. So you can't take your data elsewhere. The app owns it. It is its data. And it can do whatever it wants with it.
Now, in principle, that doesn't seem necessary. Like, you can imagine a world where I get to go in and get my cookies or whatever else is in a given website or a given app, but nobody else does, right? What's wrong with that?
So again, like, in theory, you could take your data that you have in each origin that's on your browser and you could export it, but this data is useless. It's just in an unstructured format. And a lot of the value of, like, a website, all of the whole Web 2.0 thing was people realizing, oh, wait a second, all of these apps, all these origins can share your data together in the cloud, and then they can create these really cool experiences. Like, you know, Flickr could make it so you could share your photos with anybody, and it could rank and tell you when you put tags on it. It would say, oh, well, a lot of people for this kind of tag would say hashtag day at the beach, the beach life, or whatever.
So I gather where you're going is saying, like, okay, now we're in a world where Spotify has some data about me that isn't useful to me particularly to go gather, and in any event, nobody else can have it. It doesn't travel elsewhere in a useful way easily. And you know, Facebook may have some, well, they don't in my case, but they could have some data about me. Google does blah, blah, blah. And you're saying the world of large language models kind of naturally leads to a case where one company has all this stuff about you. It just naturally happens.
So, like, we're already in that world where if you don't have any large language models or AI, we're already in a hyper-centralized world. There's a very small number of aggregators that control the vast majority of data. And now you throw LLMs into that mix and it just supercharges the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the problem. That's why it's a breaking point, I think, right now.
And by the way, I mean, they, OpenAI, I mean, they introduced products so fast, but it wasn't that long ago, a couple months or something, that they kind of got in the app business. In other words, like, there's a version of, like, there could be a version of Spotify that's kind of ported into OpenAI or GPT, so that rather than leave GPT and use Spotify, there's something about the interface to Spotify within GPT, right?
And that's a classic aggregator move. What you do is you say, hey, all the users are here already. You, as these other smaller verticals,
you have to come to us. If
you got to come
access.
To us. And by the way, we can say, you know what? We didn't like that thing you said about our CEO last week, so we're going to make it so people can't install you anymore. They can say that. It's their turf. They can do whatever they want. And that's the world. So it looks, the same. No, it's not the same. It's like a feudal system. you're like on this Lord's, you know, turf, and he can say whatever he wants about what you can
now,
do.
Now, the challenge, I mean, I would say two things. First of all, you can imagine if there were multiple LLM players, you can imagine, like, to, in terms of solving this problem, you can imagine legislation that says at any moment, OpenAI has to give me all that data that they have. It's, but it just wouldn't be in very useful form, right?
Yeah, and it's in their interest to like not make it very useful. So by the way, I'm not a lawyer and I can't speak specifically to the implications of this. I might get some of the details wrong. In the EU, there is a rule that requires companies of a certain size, I forget exactly the acronym for it, that requires companies like Google to make available all of your data and all of its services in a useful format. Mm-hmm. And this Google shipped a feature in the last 6 months or whatever to be comply with this law, which means European citizens actually can get all their data from Google in a useful format that isn't just, here's a bunch of stuff.
Useful in the sense that they can do what with it?
As in, it's structured well enough that like somebody else could write an importer and do stuff with it versus just a big dump of like, you know, deliberately obfuscated. Like some of the kind of way that you make that you go, like some of these big companies will address legislation that says you got to make an export available. Like, okay, we have a thing that will give you all your data in the form of a 5,000 page PDF.
Mm-hmm.
Like just kind of stupid. Just kind of like, guys, come on. Like, as it right? Like, yeah, we did it. We technically did it. It's like, okay, but like, that's not useful. Like, obviously, I have to go through and parse this out and OCR it now, and it's going to have all kind of weird, you know, it deliberately makes it obfuscated and difficult.
So let me pause and say, like, as I think I told you in the email when we set this up, what we generally do is this podcast, we go, you know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, something, for public audience. Then we go into overtime. That's accessible to people who have a paid subscription to the Non-Zero newsletter. I don't want to go there right now because, I mean, I do want to continue to pursue this subject and other subjects once we move to overtime. But I want to give you a sense to just say whatever you want to say by way of quickly giving people, well, whatever you want to do. If you want to give them a taste for your approach to solving this problem, the thing that Common Tools, your company, is pursuing, do that. Do whatever you want. I mean, I'll try to avoid interrupting. It's hard. I don't have much more to say
that I've already said. I think this notion of resonance versus hollowness is one of the most important questions of our age. I think more people need to wake up to like what the difference is and why we are feeling so empty in tech, politics, business. And I think that the systems in that we have this resident competing manifesto I wrote with a number, co-wrote with a number of collaborators, and it lists five characteristics that things have to have in computing to be resident. One is private. Two is dedicated. It's got to have no conflicts of interest. Three is it has to be plural, which is to say no one individual entity with overwhelming control over the ecosystem. Four, it's got to be adaptable. It's got to be open-ended, something that allows you to do things even that some PM elsewhere didn't think of to do. And five, it's got to be pro-social. That be something that helps you live in harmony with the world around you, engage with your communities, and becoming a better human being, as opposed to just kind of going into an island by yourself and becoming super competitive with everybody else. And I think those five characteristics are really important, and that we should start asking and looking for tools and services that have that characteristic. I think it's really important, especially in this world where LLMs are going to kind of supercharge everything.
Okay, I'm going to flesh out more your approach to solving this problem and get into some other things, including just some observations about the current landscape, including, you know, to what extent, you know, can OpenAI pull this off, or is the commoditization problem a really pretty grave threat to them or what? We'll get into all that. Last thing I want to give you a chance to do is tell people where they can find your stuff, newsletter, anything. I just learned what you have, like a kind of a podcast, did you say, or you don't?
I do with my friend Ashwarya Kanduja. We do every week or so, we record. I write 15 to 20 pages of personal reflections that I publish in a Google Doc each week. And then Ash reads them, selects the ones that she finds most interesting, and then we kind of talk about them. And she's a brilliant thinker, and so I often learn a lot more from her reactions to what I've written than what I wrote originally.
So where can people find this stuff? Any of your stuff?
That, I forget the exact URL, but it's something about Common Ground, what it's called. And then I need to figure out what the URL is. I should have known that. And then my personal reflections are kamarowski.com/bits-and-bobs. And that's my like weekly newsletter where I share 15 to 20 pages of reflections about society and meaning and emergence and AI and technology and apps and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, sounds good. Well, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. I hope you will join us in overtime by becoming a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. If you're not already one, at that point, you can get a customized podcast feed that'll just always give you access to these sessions